Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Thursday, September 17th, 2020. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. Our top headline, Grant County sees COVID-19 surge. Health director fears spread from college students. Although reported cases of COVID-19 are increasing at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, many students are satisfied with the precautions instituted by university leaders to ensure a safe return or first-time arrival to campus. But Grant County officials have raised the alarm that the start of the fall semester at institutions of higher education will accelerate the spread of COVID-19 within the community. Young adults tend to congregate and interact and maybe not behave as responsibly as one might during a pandemic, said Grant County Health Director Jeff Kindry. The other issue that we have is younger adults tend to have more mild symptoms, so they don't feel bad and continue to interact with others. As of 6 p.m. Wednesday, the university reported 108 positive cases, 98 of which were confirmed through the University Student Health Services Center. The facility has administered 631 tests since August 31st. The remaining tests were reported to UW-Platteville through outside sources and were comprised of 7 students and 3 employees. To slow the spread, UW-Platteville students and staff are subject to mandatory mask wearing, social distancing, and isolation protocols, and also are encouraged to undergo periodic testing for the new coronavirus. There is a lot of effort put in to keep our students here because our students told us they wanted to be here, said UW-Platteville spokesperson Paul Erickson. They want on-campus learning. They want to be in the city of Platteville. They want to be in our residence halls. They want to take advantage of student services. One of the biggest things is that they want to be using high-speed internet. The Grant County Health Department buttressed the university's efforts this week by organizing a free community COVID-19 testing site where the public and students could have their noses swabbed by Wisconsin Army National Guard members. The 2-day clinic started Wednesday, and up to 1,500 tests can be administered. Shortly before the lunch hour Wednesday, dozens of cars lined a driveway that encircled a testing area on campus, while pedestrians trickled in through side entrances. UW-Platteville senior Danny Reddington plays football for the university and said he was required to undergo a test. They are getting everyone on the football team tested in the hopes that will allow everyone to be cleared for, at very least, team workout sessions in the athletic center. Although the circumstances on campus feel weird, Reddington feels safe. I personally haven't had any in-person classes, he said. Really, I've only interacted with a handful of people without a mask. My roommate, a couple of football coaches, and a couple guys on the football team. The number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Grant County has sharply increased following the start of classes at UW-Platteville on September 2nd. The 14-day average of new cases in the 2 weeks ending September 2nd was 1.9. In the 2-week period ending Tuesday, that figure was 14.6. Meanwhile, the positivity rate increased from 2.8% in the 2 weeks ending September 2nd to 14.9% in the 14-day period that concluded on Tuesday. Over the past 2 weeks, 75% of new cases have come from 18 through 29-year-olds, Kindry said. Some 67% of positive cases in that 2-week period are associated with Platteville addresses. News of a large off-campus gathering recently prompted UW-Platteville Chancellor Dennis Shields to release an urgent video message to students, warning that students who violate safety protocols on or off campus could be subject to disciplinary proceedings, including suspension from the university. The health department remains in close contact with UW-Platteville, but the decision whether to cease face-to-face classroom instruction remains the domain of administrators. No matter what they do, it has an impact on our communities, Kindry said. The university is utilizing several metrics to evaluate whether to pivot to remote learning, including the capacity of its on-campus isolation residences, where students who live on campus and test positive for COVID-19 must relocate for 10 days. UW-Platteville has designated about 250 beds inside 2 facilities for that purpose, and as of Tuesday, fewer than 25 were occupied, Erickson said. For entering freshmen, their heavily regulated campus life feels surreal. David Flowers said he leaves his dormitory once or twice per day just to grab a meal or attend class. He considers UW-Platteville's case count to be a low number relative to its student body of about 7,500 students. I don't see it as being that big of a threat to us, Flowers said. There is still that possibility of me getting it and not knowing, and possibly going home and spreading it to my family and friends. Freshman Samantha Middlestead is making the most of on-campus social activities while keeping her eye on the positivity rate. If that positive case number starts getting closer to the amount of tests given, I'll be a little more iffy, she said. Erickson said the university's positivity rate likely is skewed because the health center has, to date, prioritized testing students who exhibit symptoms or feel ill, rather than the university population at large. Now we are starting the second round, which is widespread testing, he said. Iowa Supreme Court reviews Buelow case. The Iowa Supreme Court heard arguments Wednesday on the possible role that the exclusion of mental health records had in the murder conviction of a former Dubuque man. An attorney representing Fonte C. Buelow, age 27, argued that the exclusion of mental health records prohibited his client from fully mounting a defense in the death of his girlfriend, Samantha J. Link, age 21, of Peosta, Iowa, on March 31, 2017, inside his Cane Street residence. Link sustained 3 stab wounds, 2 of which would have been fatal, according to investigators. Buelow, who maintained Link stabbed herself, was convicted in January 2018 and sentenced to 50 years in prison. Trials like the one involving Mr. Buelow are the reason why innocent people end up in jail and why people lose trust in the criminal justice system, said David N. Fouch, an attorney for Buelow. During the trial, Buelow's attorneys attempted to introduce evidence about Link's previous struggles with mental health, but Iowa District Court Judge Monica Wittig strictly limited the information that could be admitted. Fouch told justices that Link's medical records could have been used to indicate past mental health issues that could have supported Buelow's defense. Fouch stated in a court brief that when Link died at the age of 21, she had attempted suicide at least 3 times. The jury was flatly denied from knowing all this, Fouch said. The Iowa Court of Appeals ruled in December that the medical record exclusions were improper and remanded the case to Iowa District Court of Dubuque County for a possible retrial. In a motion to the Iowa Supreme Court protesting the appellate court ruling, Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller said the mental health evidence was properly excluded based on past precedent and that any improper exclusions would have been harmless errors. Genevieve Reinkoster, Assistant Attorney General, argued Monday that determining the admission of medical records must take timeliness into account. We are trying to determine a victim's state of mind at the time they died, not at a time prior to that, Reinkoster said. Reinkoster contended in a court brief that Link's prior suicide attempts were not relevant because they were prejudicial. At trial, Wittig had ruled that expert witnesses could review Link's medical records that were within 1 year of her death because they could present evidence of Link's demeanor and mental health status close in time to the date of her death and not too remote as to be irrelevant, the brief states. Justices questioned both sides about the use of medical records. Justice Brent Appel noted that stigmas remain associated with mental illness. There is a risk when we use mental health records that a fact finder will find that a victim is less than worthy or less trustworthy, Appel said. Isn't that an issue when we have to think about in this case? Fouch argued that although medical records are private and constitutionally protected, that is not a reason for us to pull back from our search for the truth. Steve Davis, spokesman for the Iowa Judicial Branch, said he had no estimated time for the justices to rule on Wednesday's arguments, saying that rulings often depend upon the complexity of the case. District to offer free meals to all students. Starting Monday, September 21st, every student in Dubuque Community Schools can receive breakfasts and lunches at no charge. Officials notified families on Wednesday that the district had been approved to offer free meals to students and to children in the wider community after federal officials extended a waiver that gives meal programs flexibility to feed children during the COVID-19 pandemic. We're pretty excited about it, said Joanne Frank, food and nutrition manager for the district. The waivers will ensure all children will have access to healthy meals. The Dubuque District joins a rapidly growing list of local schools offering free meals to students this fall. School nutrition officials say they hope the move helps them reach more children as families navigate the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. I think we see more as they come through our pickup sites, more younger families that are just struggling, Frank said. It's just a time of struggle, and we never know who is struggling, so I think it's a great way for making it available for everybody. Starting Monday, students attending classes in the Dubuque District can access free meals at school. Students who are learning remotely through the district's online or hybrid models can pick up meals at the district's grab-and-go sites, which will also be open to all youth ages 18 and under. District officials applied to offer the free meals after U.S. Department of Agriculture officials announced they would extend COVID-19-related waivers, allowing summer meal program operators to offer no-cost meals through the end of 2020 or until funding runs out. Frank said a family paying full price for both breakfast and lunches from the district could end up saving $250 per student if the waiver lasts to the end of the year. She said she hopes that with free meals available to students, more families will participate in the district's meal program. I think we will see a bump, Frank said. In particular, families that usually don't participate due to the expense of it may decide to have their child participate in the meals. Local school districts jumped at the chance to offer students free meals this fall. officials from 37 districts and non-public schools that responded to an inquiry from Telegraph Herald all said they had been approved, were applying, or planned to apply to participate. Not knowing what services people are going to need going forward, this program really allows us the flexibility and the ability to react quickly and help fill the gaps where there is a need, said Marie Miller, Director of Food and Nutrition for Holy Family Catholic Schools. Holy Family started serving free meals to all kindergarten through 12th grade students and some early childhood students on Monday, September 14th. The system also is hosting a site at Wallert Catholic High School to provide grab-and-go meals to any child 18 and under. I feel our participation was really good from the beginning of the year, but there are some families that are taking advantage of the program since it is free for everyone, Miller said. Kyle Ganson, Director of Food and Nutrition Services in the Western Dubuque Community School District, said the move to free meals is already increasing participation. This week, the district is sending home about 430 meals with students to eat on Friday when they are not in school, double what it was before the district started offering free meals this week. More families learning entirely virtually also are taking advantage of the district's meal pickup option. It addresses a big need, Ganson said. A lot of our families have to come up with different ideas for childcare on Fridays, and that's just one less burden that they have to worry about. Sherry Kaiser, Director of Food and Nutrition for the East Dubuque, Illinois School District, said staff have been making sure to let students know they can access free meals and making it as easy as possible for them to eat. I think we're doing well, but we can always improve, she said. We just need to keep reaching out to families and offer as much as we can and get it to the kids that need it. And in our People Etc. section today, celebs join Instagram freeze to protest Facebook inaction. Kim Kardashian West, Katy Perry, Leonardo DiCaprio, and other celebrities are taking part in a 24-hour Instagram freeze on Wednesday to protest against what they say is parent company Facebook's failure to tackle violent and hateful content and election misinformation. Hollywood stars and influencers are lending their backing to the hashtag StopHateForProfit movement's latest campaign. The movement asked people to put up a message highlighting what they called the damage Facebook does, but otherwise refrain from posting on Instagram for a day. I can't sit by and stay silent while these platforms continue to allow the spreading of hate, propaganda, and misinformation created by groups to sow division and split America apart, only to take steps after people are killed, Kardashian West posted on her Instagram account on Tuesday. Facebook declined to comment, but pointed to recent announcements about what it's doing to limit the reach on its platform of groups that support violence and its efforts to protect the U.S. election in November. With 188 million followers, Kardashian West is one of the most influential people on Instagram, and support from her and other big names for the boycott saw Facebook shares slide in aftermarket trading late Tuesday. They were down 1.7% ahead of the market open on Wednesday. The organizers behind hashtag StopHateForProfit, including civil rights groups such as the Anti-Defamation League, the NAACP, and Color of Change, had previously led a campaign that got hundreds of brands and nonprofits to join a Facebook advertising boycott in July. Ashton Kutcher, Mark Ruffalo, Kerry Washington, Rosario Dawson, Jamie Foxx, and Sacha Baron Cohen were among about two dozen Hollywood stars and celebrity influencers supporting the campaign, the organizers said. DiCaprio said he was standing with the civil rights group to call on all users of Instagram and Facebook to protest the amplification of hate, racism, and the undermining of democracy on those platforms. Facebook, which earned nearly $70 billion in advertising revenue last year, is facing a reckoning over what critics call indefensible excuses for amplifying divisions, hate, and misinformation on their platforms. We are quickly approaching one of the most consequential elections in American history, organizers said. Facebook's unchecked and vague changes are falling dangerously short of what is needed to protect our democracy. In our Morning Smile article, Serval Cat Found Safe After Escape from Family's Home. A 40-pound African serval cat named Spartacus has been found safe and sound after escaping from his home and spending days in the New Hampshire wild. The cat was trapped near its home and is in good health, Merrimack Police posted on Facebook. The cat's owner, Dean King, said Spartacus ran away after getting spooked by the family dog. King adopted Spartacus from a Florida zoo 4 years ago. The family has a permit from the state's Department of Fish and Game, police said. Spartacus lives indoors, spending the days in an enclosure and roaming the family house at night. Lisa King thanked people for their support. I have a bond with this cat, and he is my person, she wrote in the Facebook post. And in our almanac section, so with today being Thursday, September 17th, it is the 261st day of 2020. There are 105 days left in this year. And on this date in history, in 1862, more than 3,600 men were killed in the Civil War Battle of Antietam. I know I said that wrong. Antietam in Maryland. In 1937, the likeness of President Abraham Lincoln's head was dedicated at Mount Rushmore. In 1971, citing health reasons, Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black, age 85, retired. He died eight days after making his announcement. In 1978, after meeting at Camp David, Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat signed a framework for a peace treaty. And in 2011, a demonstration calling itself Occupy Wall Street began in New York, prompting similar protests around the U.S. and the world. And now moving into the Dubuque and Tri-State section. Driver faces multiple charges after crash. Authorities say a Dubuque man with a stolen gun and more than $16,000 in cash, marijuana, led authorities in a high-speed chase Tuesday afternoon through downtown Dubuque, driving in an extremely dangerous and reckless manner before causing an injury, crash, and fleeing into a nearby residence. Christopher D. Evans, age 32, of 2575 Jackson Street, No. 1, was arrested at 6:17 p.m. Tuesday in the 200 block of East 17th Street on charges of felony eluding, interference with official acts with a firearm, being a felon in possession of a firearm, possession of marijuana with intent to deliver, all Class D felonies in Iowa, and carrying a concealed weapon in fourth degree theft. Class D felonies in Iowa are punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Court documents state that police stopped Evans' vehicle at 3:18 p.m. near the intersection of 16th Street and Central Avenue for fraudulent use of registration and were conducting a canine search after noticing a smell of marijuana. When Evans started the vehicle, backed up rapidly, struck the front of a squad car, and drove from the scene at a high rate of speed. An officer attempted to break the driver's window of Evans' vehicle with his baton, and several officers were in close proximity as Evans fled in the vehicle, according to documents. Squad cars pursued Evans throughout the downtown area. Evans drove in an extremely dangerous and reckless manner, violating numerous traffic laws with speeds reaching approximately 70 miles per hour, documents state. Evans' vehicle was traveling south on Jackson Street at the intersection with East 20th Street. When he crossed over to the wrong side of the road and struck a vehicle driven north on Jackson by Lori K. Johnson, age 51, of Dubuque. Evans' vehicle then swiped a southbound vehicle driven by Donald J. Jacquinot, age 64, of Platteville, Wisconsin. Johnson and three passengers, Casey M. Lumpkins, age 30, infant Calvin T. Lumpkins, and three-year-old Blanche Lumpkins, Jr., all of Dubuque, were transported to Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital for treatment of their injuries, according to police. Evans exited the vehicle after the crash and fled on foot, police said. Traffic camera footage showed an object falling on the ground as Evans left the vehicle. Officers discovered that the object was a plastic bag containing 4.46 grams of marijuana. Footage also showed Evans wearing a white bag over his shoulder. Evans ran south from the crash scene with an officer in pursuit on foot. The officer lost sight of Evans in the alley between Jackson and Washington Streets, police said. A witness told police Evans had run into a residence in the 200 block of East 17th Street. Officers found the bag Evans had been wearing on the roof of a residence in the 200 block of East 19th Street. Documents state that the bag contained a handgun that was discovered to have been stolen from Memphis, Tennessee. At approximately 5:54 p.m., Evans came out of the 17th Street residence and was taken into custody. Officers recovered $16,840 in cash from Evans and marijuana weighing 13.76 grams. Evans also was cited with 15 traffic violations, police said. Sexual assault trial begins in Dubuque. The trial for a Waterloo, Iowa man accused of sexually assaulting a Dubuque woman began on Wednesday. Opening statements and first witnesses were called for the trial of Patrick H. Booker, age 47, who is charged with first-degree kidnapping and third-degree sexual abuse forcible rape. If convicted of the first-degree kidnapping charge, Booker would serve a mandatory life sentence in prison without the possibility of parole. Witnesses testifying Wednesday included the woman accusing Booker and medical professionals who treated her. The Telegraph Herald does not identify victims of alleged sexual assault. The trial was the first to take place in the Dubuque County Courthouse in months because of COVID-19. To allow for social distancing, jurors were not seated in the jury box, were spread out throughout the courtroom in spectator seating. Everyone in the courtroom wore masks, and those who spoke used a microphone. The charges stem from an incident that occurred on April 14, 2018. Booker and two other men were invited to the home of the woman to attend a tattoo party. In his opening statement, Assistant County Attorney Richard Kirkendall said the woman had originally intended to have sex with Booker and one of his friends. However, at midnight, Booker allegedly ordered her to have sex with a third person as well, who was also identified as a friend of Booker's. Kirkendall said the woman, whose clothes were removed, then left the room and entered the kitchen. There, Booker slammed her head into a wall. Booker then allegedly opened a window in the kitchen when outside temperatures were about 32 degrees and forced her to wait in the kitchen for several hours. Anytime she tried to leave the kitchen, Booker allegedly struck her again. For hours, she was standing naked in that kitchen, Kirkendall said. She shivered and she pled with him, "Don't make me stand here." Every time she did that, he slammed her head against the wall. Hours later, at about 5:30 a.m., Booker allowed the woman to return to her room, Kirkendall said. She lay face down on the bed, and Booker allegedly proceeded to sexually assault her. In a brief opening statement, Teresa Sampson Brown, defense attorney for Booker, stated that Booker was caught in a bad situation. "This was a web that Mr. Booker got tangled up in," Brown said, later adding, "We ask you to keep an open mind until all the evidence comes in." When called to testify, the woman stated she had known Booker before and had organized for him and some of his friends to drive to her home for a tattoo party, where attendees could receive tattoos or piercings. The woman said she agreed ahead of the party to have sex with Booker and one of his friends. At midnight during the party, though, she said she was ordered by Booker to have sex with the third friend as well. "I said that I felt uncomfortable," she said. Patrick followed me. The woman repeated the story previously given by Kirkendall, where Booker struck her in the kitchen and forced her to remain there naked for hours while a window remained open. Every time she tried to leave or call for help, Booker struck her again, according to the testimony. The assault left her with lacerations to the head and lip. "He was looking at me in a way that I'll never forget," she said. "I was scared and just stopped and stared in the corner." The woman said she was eventually allowed to return to her room and put some clothes on. After lying on the bed on her stomach, she said she was sexually assaulted by Booker. The trial is scheduled to continue this morning. Dubuque County adds 2 deaths. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Wednesday's developments included 55 additional cases of COVID-19 in Dubuque County were confirmed from 5 p.m. Tuesday to 5 p.m. Wednesday, pushing the county's total to 2,474. The county recorded 208 new tests in that 24-hour period, so the county's positivity rate was 26% during that span. The county's to-date positivity rate was 9.2% as of 5 p.m. Wednesday. There were 2 additional COVID-19-related deaths reported in Dubuque County in that 24-hour period, bringing the total deaths in the county to 40. With 417 new confirmed cases and 2,576 tests in the previous 2 weeks, the county's 14-day positivity rate as of 5 p.m. Wednesday was 16.2%. The Telegraph Herald's calculation, based on the state's totals, continues to exceed the state's reported 14-day positivity rate due to the state's practice of not counting recent confirmed cases until all data is received. This practice drives down the positivity rate, even though those cases have been confirmed in a specific county. At 5 p.m. Wednesday, the state reported Dubuque's county's 14-day positivity rate as 11.8%. By subtracting the number of related deaths and recovered in Dubuque County from the number of confirmed cases, there were 600 active cases as of 5 p.m. Wednesday, an increase of 35 from 24 hours earlier. 8 more cases were reported in the 24-hour period in Delaware County, 1 more in Clayton County, 10 more in Jackson County, and 4 more in Jones County. There are 16 people in Dubuque County hospitalized with COVID-19 as of Tuesday, the most recent state reported data. Jackson and Jones counties reported 3 hospitalized. Delaware County reported 2, and Clayton County had none as of Tuesday. Statewide, 891 new cases were reported in the 24-hour span ending at 5 p.m. Wednesday, pushing the tally to 76,283. There were 3 additional related deaths, so that toll moved to 1,237. In Wisconsin, Grant County had an increase of 34 cases on Wednesday. Iowa County and Crawford County each had 1 additional case, which, while Lafayette County did not have any new cases. Statewide, 1,408 new cases were reported Wednesday, pushing the total to 92,712. There were 8 additional related deaths, so the state count moved to 1,228. In Illinois, 1,941 new confirmed cases were reported Wednesday, along with 35 additional confirmed deaths. That brings the state's totals to 266,151 cases and 8,367 deaths. Joe Davies County reported 3 additional cases on Wednesday. Cast members from Tiger King coming to Five Flags. Fans of Tiger King, a hit Netflix series, will be able to get the inside scoop on the show when members of the cast make a stop in Dubuque in November. Uncaged, the untold stories from the cast of Tiger King, is scheduled to take place at 8 p.m. Saturday, November 14th at Five Flags Center, officials at the venue announced Wednesday. Audience members will be able to experience never-before-seen videos and pictures, as well as ask questions. People love a good train wreck as long as it's not their train wreck, and that's what this show was, just constantly waiting to see what was going to go wrong next, said Five Flags Center General Manager H.R. Cook. During the COVID shut-in, everyone was watching. I don't know that it would have done as well for us during any other time, but I do think that the show's popularity and people still talking about it, as well as Carol Baskin appearing on Dancing with the Stars and the new movie coming out with Nicolas Cage, that people will be interested. The show will begin with a 70-minute moderated discussion with cast members. The last 20 minutes will include a question-and-answer session with the audience. Appearing will be John Reinke, Saf Safari, Joshua Dial, and Barbara Fisher. The show will be moderated by podcast veteran and comedian Todd McComas. A special meet and greet also will take place following the show, including an exclusive question and answer session with the cast, a limited edition autograph poster, and the chance to take a photo with the cast. The appearance, appropriate for a PG-13 crowd, is only one of 2 stops on the tour so far, both taking place in Iowa. Uncaged will be in Cedar Rapids the day before his Dubuque show. It's a brand new show, so no one has seen this yet because most venues throughout the country are still shut down, Cook said. So all eyes are on Iowa right now to see what we're doing and how we're handling things, as we're one of the few states hosting shows. Cook said only 1,000 tickets will be sold to the event, which will take place in the Five Flags Arena in order to accommodate social distancing. The arena ordinarily can accommodate up to 4,000. Other safety protocols will also be in place to help patrons feel safe. Or feel at ease. It feels a little weird, Cook admitted, of gradually opening up the venue for live events to take place again. We've hosted a few shows, but we've basically been shut down since March. I think we're going to see a lot more shows, like this smaller and shifting, to fill a void. Man hurt in crash. Authorities said a man was injured Tuesday in a single-vehicle Dubuque crash. Eldon Lemer, age 45 of Dubuque, was transported to an Iowa City hospital for treatment of his injuries, according to Dubuque County Sheriff Joe Kennedy. Kennedy said deputies responded at 6:36 a.m. to U.S. 52 South on the Cave Hill for a vehicle in the ditch. An unoccupied vehicle was found that had crashed into a culvert and trees and down an embankment. Lemmer was located at Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital and later taken to an Iowa City hospital, Kennedy said. Lemmer had been delivering newspapers at the time of the crash. We are unsure of what time the crash actually occurred, since the vehicle was abandoned when deputies got there, Kennedy said. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Thursday, September 17th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Lawrence F. Cruz, known as Larry, age 75 of Dubuque, passed away Wednesday, September 9th, at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center as a result of an auto accident. A massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, September 19th, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Reverend Mark Osterhaus will preside, and Reverend Phil Cruz will celebrate. Mass are required, and social distancing should be observed. Mass will be broadcast on Facebook at Kramer Funeral Home. Since Larry so generously deeded his body to science, burial will be held at a later date at St. Francis Cemetery in Dyersville. Larry was born April 21, 1945, near Chicago, Illinois, the son of Leander Moose and Margaret Cruz. He graduated from St. Leo High School in Chicago, earned a B.A. at Loras College, and a master's degree from the University of Notre Dame. He taught at RHCL in Holy Cross, Iowa, and over 20 years at NICC in Peosta. Since retirement, he was an active volunteer at the Presentation Lantern Center, a center offering hospitality, educational opportunities, and advocacy to adult immigrants. Condolences may be sent to Lawrence Cruz in care of Kramer Funeral Home at 750 12th Avenue Southeast, Dyersville, Iowa, 52040, or sent online to www.kramerfuneral.com. Please keep the family in your thoughts and prayers. Jean L. Wilkinson, age 72, of Waynesville, Ohio, passed away Thursday, September 10th, at Hospice of Dayton in Ohio. Jean retired from Chrysler Corps in Belvidere, Illinois in 2008 after 41 years of service. He served as a representative of the United Auto Workers for several years. He was also a member of the Galena United Methodist Church in Illinois. Outgoing, fun-loving, and a workaholic, Jean especially enjoyed being out with friends and his grandchildren. While living in Galena, he took every opportunity to explore the recreational area around the lake. He's also loved taking the grandkids to Happy Joe's in Galena for pizza and ice cream. Remodeling work was a passion, and he always looked forward to his next project. Other hobbies included dancing, dining out, going to movies, Lake Michigan boat trips from Chicago, attending pasty festivals, and seeking out a quality slice of cherry pie. Between his Dodge pickup truck and the pontoon boat he owned for a while, he always found time for quality relaxation. Among many things, he'll be remembered for how much he enjoyed and took advantage of all four seasons of the year. He was preceded in death by his parents, Maynard and Florence Wilkinson. He is survived by his caretaker and former wife, Myrna Wilkinson, daughter Stephanie Marizald, son Anthony L. Wilkinson, 8 grandchildren, 7 great-grandchildren, and 1 brother, Daryl Wilkinson. A memorial service will be held 7 p.m. Friday, September 18th, at Stubbs Connor Funeral Home in Waynesville, Ohio. Jesse Branham will be officiating the services. The family will receive friends from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at the funeral home. If desired, contributions may be made to the American Diabetes Association. Condolences can be left at www.stubbsconner.com. Ralph H. Mukow, age 91 of Galena, died September 16th at his home. Funeral service will be at 7 p.m. Monday, September 21st at the Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena, where friends may gather after 4 p.m. until time of service. Arrangements are pending at the Furlong Funeral Home. William C. Thusing, age 69 of Galena, died September 14th, 2020 at his home. In keeping with his wishes, there will be no public services. Cremation rites will be accorded. The Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena is in charge of arrangements. Mildred M. Grimmels, age 94 of Dubuque, died September 14th. Visitation will be from 10:30 to 11 a.m. on Saturday, September 19th, at the Mueller Memorial Chapel in Linwood Cemetery. Services will follow at 11 a.m. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is entrusted with arrangements. Interment will be in Linwood Cemetery. Marjorie Ann Garthwaite of Bagley passed away at Great River Care Center on September 14th. She was born the first child of Jesse and Clara McComb on September 11, 1927. An eternal optimist, she lived a long life with many accomplishments. The grass never grew too long under her feet. She graduated valedictorian of her class at the Bagley School and pursued a rural teaching certificate, as teachers were greatly needed at this time. The following year, she spent teaching at the rural Glass Hollow School. Next, she earned a bachelor's degree in English education at the University of Dubuque. Her first full-time teaching contract was in Boyden, Iowa. Then, a contract came from Garnerville, Iowa, where she could be found arriving by flat-bottom boat from Bagley most Monday mornings. There, she was greeted by a supportive community who formed a forensics program. Several of her students received the top award at the state competition. At her father's urging, she applied and was accepted to teach English for the Department of Defense, dependent schools, located on military bases overseas. Troop transport ships were dispatched from Seattle to the rocky little atoll of Okinawa, Japan, which is where she found herself teaching and traveling before moving on to Baumholder, Germany. Traveling took on a passion, and she spearheaded many treks throughout Asia, Europe, Oceania, and the Middle East during school breaks. Upon returning to the United States, she matriculated to the University of Wisconsin Master's Program for a degree in English education. At this time, she also resumed teaching English at Platteville High School in Wisconsin. Here she developed the philosophy that I will teach to please myself and enjoy teaching. Again, she developed a forensics program and produced several plays. The next teaching job came from a Shira girls' school located near Moshi at the base of Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania, East Africa. Sadly, her time was made short due to her father's passing, and plans to return overseas never materialized. Love eventually entered the narrative, and she was married to Leland G. Quick on April 5, 1969. The teaching career was retired, and a passion for farming was pursued. This was interrupted by the birth of a daughter, Michelle. The marriage was cut abruptly with the passing of Leland 6 years later. She returned to Bagley, taught Sunday school and Bible study, until she married Lloyd O. Garthwaite on December 26, 1980. His small dairy farm in Mount Hope was the perfect place to enjoy life while still working with the Methodist Church in town teaching a weekly Bible study. This continued for 20 years until his death, when life brought her back to Bagley. Again, she took up working at Zion Lutheran Church in Bagley, teaching Bible study and Sunday school. At Marjorie's request, no funeral services are planned. A small graveside service will take place at a later date. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in McGregor, Iowa, is helping the family with the arrangements. Judith Adams, age 79, of Platteville, passed away peacefully on September 14th at Upland Hills Health Nursing Home and Rehabilitation Center in Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Memorial services will be held on Sunday, September 20th at 3 p.m. at the Lutheran Church of Peace in Platteville. Private family burial will be held at Eastside Cemetery in Dodgeville. Friends may call from 1 to 2:45 p.m. on Sunday at the church. The Melby Funeral Home and Crematory is serving the family. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made in her name to the Judith Adams Scholarship Fund and will be awarded to students at Dodgeville High School. Online condolences may be made at www.melbyfh.com. The family asks that masks be worn and social distancing respected when in attendance. Judy was born and raised in Dodgeville, Wisconsin, the oldest child of Gerald and Delva Harris. She attended the Dodgeville Public High School system, graduating from Dodgeville High School in 1959. During her years in high school, she was active in music, forensics, student council, and 4-H. She was also the majorette for the marching band and editor of the school paper. She was voted Iowa County 4-H Queen in 1959 and also selected as a Badger Girls State Representative. Judy graduated from UW-Platteville in 1963, majoring in biology and home economics. In 1969, she received her master's degree in guidance counseling from UW-Platteville. In 1961, Judy married her longtime sweetheart, Richard Adams. The couple was blessed with 4 children. Judy was a terrific wife and mother. Judy's educational career spanned over 4 states, Dubuque, Iowa, middle school counselor, Painesdale, Michigan, biology and home economics teacher, Elkhart, Indiana, middle school counselor, Potosi, Wisconsin, high school counselor, Dodgeville, Wisconsin, high school counselor. The last 2 positions spanned over 30 years. Judy touched the lives of thousands of students. She was an advocate for students that faced financial and emotional difficulties. Her attributes of patience, kindness, and compassion will be remembered and missed. Judy didn't believe in wasting time. She'll be remembered spending hours in her gardens preparing delicious meals, working on sewing products, and enjoying coffee with good friends. But Judy's passion was her family. She was a dedicated mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. She treasured her children and enjoyed each moment with them. Being an educator, Judy was interested in her grandchildren's education. She would spend time in their classroom, hours at athletic events, and concerts, and keeping them active outdoors. These times have given her children lasting memories. A special thanks to the home healthcare workers that allowed Judy to stay in her home for many years. Also, the family would like to thank the nursing staff, Tony and Mary Sue of Upland Hills, for their tremendous love and care they showed Judy during the past 2 years, and Upland Hills Hospice for their excellent care. Patty J. Lindecker, age 58, of Dubuque, died Monday, September 14th at Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital, with her family by her side. Private family services will be held at a later date. Entombment will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery Mausoleum. Patty was born December 28, 1961 in Dubuque, daughter of Milton and Corinne Chapman. On November 21, 1981, she married Pete Lindecker at the Church of the Nativity. She is survived by her husband, Pete, a son, Lucas Peter Earl Lundecker of Dubuque, and their children, Clayton, Haley, and Lauren, and a daughter, Natalie Thompson, and their children, Austin and Ava. She is also survived by four siblings, Rick Chapman, Lynn Schluter, Sandy Hahn, and Danny Chapman, and many nieces and nephews and in-laws. Patty treasured her family, especially her grandkids. A perfect day was held at home with all of her family together, including her dog, the gentle giant Bammer. The Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home at 2659 Kennedy Road is in charge of arrangements. The family would like to thank Dr. Edward Miles, Dr. Eric Engelman, Dr. Jason Ellis, and the nurses and staff at Unity Point Health, Finley, and Mercy One for their care. Gerald W. Hall, age 73, of Prairie du Chien, passed away Tuesday, September 15th, at Divine Health Care in Fenimore, Wisconsin. Funeral services will be Saturday, September 19th, 2020, at 10 a.m. at the Garrity Funeral Home Chapel, Monsignor Charles Stoetzel officiating, with burial in the Calvary Cemetery, both in Prairie du Chien. Friends may call at the funeral home on Saturday from 9 a.m. until the time of services. John W. Hune, age 81, of Platteville, died September 13th. Friends may call from 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, September 18th, at the Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville. Private family services will be held at the Lutheran Church of Peace in Platteville. Burial with military rites will be at Hillside Cemetery in Platteville. Mary C. Onsorge, who was known as Cindy, age 72, of Dubuque, died September 15th. To celebrate Cindy's life, family and friends may visit from 3 to 5 p.m. Friday, September 18th, at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. To honor Cindy's life, funeral services will be held immediately following visitation at 5 p.m. Friday at the funeral home. Vernon L. Wyatt, age 65, of Prairie du Chien, died September 15th. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. The Garrity Funeral Home of Prairie du Chien is assisting the family. Now heading back over in news, Biden says he trusts vaccines and scientists, not Trump. Joe Biden said Wednesday that while he trusts that what scientists say about a potential coronavirus vaccine, he doesn't trust President Donald Trump. The Democratic nominee's comments come as the debate over a vaccine, how it will be evaluated and distributed when it's ready, has taken center stage in the presidential race with 7 weeks to go until the November election. Trump and Biden have been trading accusations that the other is undermining public trust in a potential coronavirus vaccine. Biden has expressed concerns that the vaccine approval process could be politicized, while Trump and his allies counter that such comments from Biden and other Democrats are turning off the public to a potentially life-saving vaccine when it's released. Biden, speaking in Wilmington, Delaware, after being briefed by public health experts about a potential vaccine, cited Trump's incompetence and dishonesty surrounding the distribution of personal protective equipment and coronavirus testing. "The U.S. can't afford to repeat those fiascos when it comes to a vaccine," he said. "I trust vaccines. I trust scientists, but I don't trust Donald Trump," Biden said. "And at this moment, the American people can't either." On Wednesday evening, Trump raised new questions about the administration's rollout of a vaccine when he publicly contradicted the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who said at a congressional hearing earlier Wednesday that a vaccine wouldn't be broadly available to most Americans until the summer of 2021. Trump said that CDC Director Robert Redfield had misspoken and that the U.S. could start distributing a vaccine starting in mid-October. "I think he made a mistake when he said that. I think it's just incorrect information," Trump said of Redfield's comments. "When he said it, I believe he was confused." Trump also contradicted Redfield on the use of masks. The CDC director told lawmakers that masks are a more effective means of protection against the coronavirus than a potential vaccine. But Trump said he spoke to Redfield afterward about his comments, and that if you ask him, he'd probably say that he didn't understand the question. "There are a lot of problems with masks," Trump said. Nothing left in the bucket. Wildfire resources run thin. Justin Silvera came off the fire lines in Northern California after a grueling 36 straight days battling wildfires and evacuating residents ahead of the flames. Before that, he and his crew had worked for 20 days, followed by a three-day break. Silvera, a 43-year-old battalion chief with CAL FIRE, California State Firefighting Agency, said he's lost track of the blazes he's fought this year. He and his crew have sometimes been on duty for 64 hours at a stretch, their only rests coming in 20-minute catnaps. I've been at this 23 years, and by far this is the worst I've seen, Silvera said before bunkering down at a motel for 24 hours. After working in Santa Cruz County, his next assignment was to head north to attack wildfires near the Oregon border. His exhaustion reflects the situation on the West Coast fire lines. This year's blazes have taxed the human, mechanical, and financial resources of the nation's wildfire-fighting forces to an extraordinary degree. And half of the fire season is yet to come. Heat, drought, and a strategic decision to attack the flames early, combined with the coronavirus, to put a historically heavy burden on fire teams. There's never enough resources, said Silvera, one of nearly 17,000 firefighters battling the California blazes. Typically, with CAL FIRE, we're able to attack. Air tankers, choppers, dozers, we're good at doing that. But these conditions in the field, the drought, the wind, this stuff is just taking off. We can't contain one before another erupts. Demand for firefighting resources has been high since mid-August, when fire officials bumped the national preparedness level to critical, meaning at least 80% of crews were already committed to fighting fires, and there were few personnel and little equipment to spare. Because of the extreme fire behavior, you can't say for sure having more resources would make a difference, said Carrie Bilbao, a spokesperson for the National Interagency Fire Center. Officials at the U.S. government operation in Boise, Idaho, help decide which fires get priority when equipment and firefighters run scarce nationwide. Government spending on fighting wildfires has more than tripled since the 1990s to an average of $1.8 billion annually. That's failed to reduce the problem as climate change, drought, and millions of trees killed by pests led to more fires in the western U.S. over the same period, particularly dangerous megafires that burn 100,000 acres or more. The growing severity has spurred federal lawmakers to push prevention efforts, including controlled burns, faster approval of logging projects, and upgrading homes to make them more fire-resistant. California alone has spent $529 million since July 1st on wildfires, said Daniel Berland, Assistant Deputy Director of CAL FIRE. By comparison, the state spent $691 million the entire fiscal year that ended June 30th. The U.S. government will reimburse most state costs for the biggest disasters. No emergency training for crew on boat where fire killed 34. Crew members on a dive boat say they were never instructed on emergency procedures before a pre-dawn fire swept through the vessel as it was anchored off the Southern California coast, killing 34 people as they slept below deck, according to federal documents released Wednesday. National Transportation Safety Board investigators say the cause of the blaze aboard the Conception remains undetermined, but a possible ignition point was phones and other electronics plugged into outlets. One crew member told investigators he saw sparks when he plugged in his cell phone hours before the fire. The boat was carrying 33 passengers on a Labor Day weekend scuba diving expedition last year. The fire broke out on the final night of the Conception as the Conception was anchored off Santa Cruz Island, about 25 miles south of Santa Barbara, the boat's home port. All of the passengers and one crew member sleeping below deck were killed, none apparently having a chance to escape. The other five crew members, including Captain Jerry Boylan, survived by jumping into the water. They barely escaped after trying in vain to save the others, authorities said. Boylan made a mayday call at 3:14 a.m. saying, "I can't breathe," before abandoning ship. They got into a nearby boat whose captain kept calling for help as Conception crew members returned to search for survivors. It took more than an hour after Boylan's first mayday call for the Coast Guard and other boats to arrive. The Conception sank just after daybreak. Boylan could face federal manslaughter counts, and recent court documents say criminal charges are imminent. The NTSB has said all six crew members were asleep when the fire broke out, a violation of Coast Guard regulations requiring a roving watch. Hundreds of pages of documents released by the Safety Board provide a detailed look at the boat's final hours on September 2, 2019. It will vote October 20th on the investigation's findings, as well as the blaze's probable cause and any potential recommendations. Families of 32 victims also have filed claims against the boat owners. Glenn Dana Fritzler and the boat company, Truth Aquatics. In turn, the Fritzlers and the company have filed a legal claim to shield them from damages under a maritime law that limits liability for vessel owners. Court filings show they have offered to settle lawsuits with dozens of victims' families. Attorneys for the victims' families, Sims, Boylan, and the Fritzlers, didn't immediately return requests for comment. A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles that's investigating the case declined to comment. Boylan and the Fritzlers, who owned three dive boats, had a good reputation with customers and the Santa Barbara boating community. Coast Guard records show the Conception had passed its two most recent safety inspections. UK to ration COVID-19 testing amid testing failures. U.S. lawmakers criticized the government's handling of the COVID-19 testing crisis for a second day Wednesday, as opposition leaders claimed Prime Minister Boris Johnson lacked a cohesive plan to tackle the virus at a time when the country faces a second wave of the pandemic. Johnson defended his efforts to increase testing capacity, telling the House of Commons that the government was responding to a colossal increase in demand and arguing that Britain is testing more people than other European countries. But Angela Rayner, who led the weekly questioning for the Labour Party, said he should get some skates on to ensure the country is ready for the colder winter months ahead when the infection rates are expected to soar. They've had 6 months to get this right, and yet the Prime Minister still can't deliver on his promises, Rayner said. The Health Secretary said yesterday it would take weeks to sort this situation out. We don't have weeks. The squeeze on tests came amid a surge in COVID-19 cases across the UK that has pushed daily new infections to levels not seen since late May and has forced the Conservative government to impose limits on public gatherings. Figures released Wednesday showed 3,991 new confirmed infections during the previous 24 hours, markedly from 3,105 a day earlier. Widespread testing is seen as crucial to controlling the spread of the virus because it allows those who are infected to self-isolate while helping health officials identify hotspots and trace those who are infected. Johnson said Wednesday the government would ration coronavirus testing, giving priority to health workers and care home staff after widespread reports that people around the country were unable to schedule tests. We have massively increased our capacity, he told lawmakers on a key oversight committee. I know many people have had infuriating experiences, and I do sympathize, but 89% get their results within 24 hours. Justice Secretary Robert Buckland told Sky News that the government was drawing up a new priority list for testing, suggesting that students and their families could be next in line after the National Health Service and social care. Over the past 2 days, lawmakers from all parties have bombarded the government with a litany of complaints from constituents desperate to get tests so they can return to school or work or visit elderly loved ones. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, September 17th, 2020. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.